And how about Helen? What I think you have been here for several years now, right?
Yes. What did I do over the holidays?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first years I was here, I used to try and find a very high floor, go to someone's apartment and be on the 25th floor to see the view.
Mm.
And last year I went to the Bell and Drum Square, which was Hutong style fireworks, which was wonderful. And this year I was just in my local street, in my local neighbourhood. So every year I have a different experience. It was
so
very nice.
You must be pretty experienced because you've been here since 2007, is that true?
I first came here in 2006 off the Trans-Siberian Railway, arriving in like February time, and then I came to live here sort of full-time in the beginning of 2007.
Mm. So in Dominic's email, he introduced you as a conceptual artist. Well, it's a rather big term, right? Can you define a conceptual artist to us?
Well, I normally call myself an artist, which is more broad and a little less grand. I guess if you have to divide people up into sort of subcategories, conceptual fits me quite well because I feel that my work is very ideas led, and I guess conceptual simply is ideas. As the purpose of the work.
This means that unlike the traditional idea of an artist, you're not just working with making oil paintings. You work with all kinds of material.
I actually feel that the materials are very important. So when I say I'm ideas led, I think the materials inform my work too. But the ideas are the primary source of the work. And in terms of material, I could be making conceptual art with painting, probably. Although there's a big debate about painting in art these days as a traditional medium, and does it portray contemporary ideas as well as other mediums? So that's an enormous subject of its own. But yes.
And one of your most well-received works you made since being in Beijing was a photographic study of the workers that helped to create the Bird's Nest Stadium and the Olympic Village. Can you tell us a little more about this work?
Yes, I had been going up to the Olympic Park quite regularly before the Olympics. Generally speaking, in my work, I'm very interested in changing landscapes, and I came to Beijing thinking about that.
That is the first landscape you took interest in after you came to China, or that is the one after a few years search.
I was interested in Beijing changing as a whole, and I still am very much influenced by that in my work.
Mm-hmm.
But the Olympics, it became clear to me that the Olympics was very important, of
That's
course,
for sure.
And that those buildings represented, I don't know, what I would almost call like a rebranding for Chinese identity. Suddenly, you would be inviting the world to see the Olympics, maybe not the Forbidden City or other more traditional things, but giving a new view of China, sporting country with amazing architecture. And so I suddenly realized this was a very important moment. So I was going up there all the time taking photographs and getting more and more interested. And typically for me, taking photographs of the buildings and the earth and the ground and the change. But I started talking to the workers in my very minimal Chinese, and they were such
great. I'm sure they'd love to talk to you.
We had great conversations, even with very minimal words. It was great. And I start taking photos of them just to be friendly, you know, what do you do? This is great. And it just occurred to me very quickly that they were the key to the project, actually. They were the most important part.
Sure.
And so I went back and I took photographs of 143 people who agreed to participate, and over 2 days, I set it as only 2 days, otherwise I could have been taking pictures of workers for years and years. There's so many people working here.
That's true.
And then I went back for 2 days and waited to meet them again and gave them a copy of their photograph.
How long how long does it take to take a photo of each of them? I mean, do they just stand there and ask you to take a photo, or do they ask you to give a suggestion about making what kind of posture and that sort of thing?
I had an idea that I wanted to take them all in the same spot. So that's where I was standing, and that was easy to to do. Mm. I think the thing that takes the longest time is the talking to people about what you're doing.
Ah,
that was the conversations were interesting, and of course some people said yes straight away, some people said maybe I'll come back later, some people, one young man just watched me for about 20 minutes or half an hour just to see what exactly I was doing, but he was very interested and he participated.
So if you made a book about this, and it's a big book, and to the uninitiated, if they just flick through the pictures, they'll see repetitive pictures of workmen. However, if you look more closely, you can really see the personality of these guys and their clothes, and they're so natural and at ease, and you can see their facial expressions. Some seem proud, some seem a little confused about what you're doing. Do you do any preparation before you take the picture? Do you say anything to them to make them more relaxed, or is it simply stand here, you press the button, and that's that?
In this case, I mean, obviously with portraits it varies, but in this case I was quite quick, partly because they're working men and they weren't meant to be talking to me really, you know, they were meant to be getting on with their job, so I didn't want to keep them. Secondly, the time that it took to tell them what I was doing was the most important bit in a way for the process of the interaction between us.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actual taking of the photo, once they understood what I was doing and wanted to participate, the actual taking of the photo was quite quick, and I did that deliberately because I didn't want it to get too staid or too posed. Not that I suspect they would particularly pose, but just I wanted it to be a little bit more spontaneous.
And were there any particular workers that you photographed who were particularly memorable to you?
Yes, there's a couple of people, quite a few actually, that really stick in my mind. There was one wonderful chap who I photographed quite early on, and he's distinct in the book if anyone has a copy. He had a gold pen in his top pocket, and he's very proud in the photo of what he's achieved in the project, you can just tell. And he was very influential amongst a lot of the men and some of the women who were in the photographs. He really encouraged people to participate. Mm-hmm. And I could hear, even though I didn't fully understand, there was a lot of discussion going on between him and other people, like, you should be in this. This is very nice, very interesting. And I really enjoyed meeting him.
Yeah, I saw that photograph, and this guy didn't have a hard hat. I think that's correct.
Mm.
So I think he must have been in some managerial position.
Everybody should have a safety hat, right?
Well, maybe he didn't have it because we were on the ground outside the building. Maybe.
Uh-huh. So, and you say each of these men received a photograph that you took of them. Mm-hmm. Did you have any feedback? I mean, do you know what they thought of the project, if they were proud of their pictures?
Most people got the photograph. As I say, I went back and I waited. I took the photos over 2 days, and then I said, I'll come back and I'll wait for 2 days, because I had no opportunity to make an appointment with them or contact them, really. So I said I would wait. And, of course, that meant that I probably met about maybe 80% of the people again, and 20% I never met. Mm-hmm. So the people I didn't meet, you'll see in the book, there's no signature, and you can't see where they came from because I didn't see them again. Mm-hmm. And they also didn't receive the print.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the sort of people, in a way, who, for me, it's sort of like, it was obviously not my intention that I would miss people, but as I have missed people, it's quite apt, because it's all the people that you don't meet again, that you don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You see very briefly, they do something important, maybe they work right beside you for a while, but you don't know them. China's got such a big population. I feel I see working people all the time, and I may not even notice them. I don't even know anything about them, and they're all around me.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was quite an interesting part of the project, in a way. And as for meeting the rest, yes, people did give me feedback. Again, I would love to have fluent Chinese. Again, there was a lot of talking. People came back very enthusiastically to get prints, reminded their friends to come back to get their prints. It felt like a very positive experience. But people were definitely thinking about it, you know, what this means too. I got that feeling.
Yeah, obviously that is not your first project, right, Helen?
No.
Can you still remember your first project in China?
I can.
Ah.
When I first came to Beijing, I was very struck by the contradiction, or not contradiction, that's the wrong word, but the contrast between old Beijing and new Beijing, and also this feeling of kind of communication, because in a way Beijing is this northern city, seems kind of a bit far away from from where I'm from, certainly far away from a lot of other places. And I was very interested in the idea of communication, so advertising, hoardings, and satellite dishes and so on. And I photographed the advertising hoardings that were then all around the Third Ring Road, now in places where they've built enormous new buildings. Mm-hmm. But at that time, there were just these enormous advertising hoardings.
Advertising what?
Advertising, I don't remember actually. It was just the structure of these things that was important. Mm-hmm. Coming from the UK, I'd never seen such big advertising.
Big boards.
Enormous, huge. It was just amazing.
Probably, I think that they borrowed that from the US, right?
Probably. Yeah. The scale was just something mm-hmm. I wasn't familiar with. So I did that, and then that influenced a series of work I did, which I called Gift, which I did in 2006, my first show up in 798. And it was the idea was to think about what I would take home, because at that stage I was hoping to live here, but I hadn't actually moved here. Mm-hmm. I was here for 2 months to work on that show in the spring of 2006.
Obviously, that gave you a wonderful impression of the city.
It was really interesting time. Mm-hmm. And immediately, on day three of being here, wanted to come and live here. So I had a very strong feeling.
Why? What was the attraction?
It was a combination of things, I think, if I can remember rightly. Mm. Of course, it takes about 3 days just to stop being jet-lagged or understand where the supermarket is, know how to eat something.
Very important.
It takes you just 3 days.
And
That's quick.
I know. I know exactly which street I was in. I was in a street in Chuanjihu, and I remember thinking, Yes, I'm going to come and live here.
Yeah, nice neighborhood.
I like that neighborhood.
I'm familiar with that neighborhood.
It's very nice.
Right.
What was it about that neighborhood that made you think this is where you want to be?
It's a living neighborhood. There are a lot of people, you know, there's ordinary everyday people, and it's very convenient to live.
It's a nice combination, I think, of established Beijing, traditional settled in Beijing people, and also the feeling that it's quite lively and close to the center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
so true. You've been here now, 3 years working as a full-time artist?
Absolutely, yes.
I'm interested to know how living in Beijing has influenced your work. I saw many of your works on the internet, and I know that one repetitive thing seems to be the image of a fan, like the Chinese fans. Mm. What is it about the fan which you find fascinating?
This is, I think, a very good question. When I first got here, I made this project, and I was interested to think about what I was taking home, you know, when I was only going to be here for 2 months. You know, you go somewhere and you kind of observe something about somebody else and another culture, and you think, what am I taking home from this? You know, is it just going to be an experience where I get back on the plane and I've forgotten it was like a dream? Or will I be able to show something of my time here? And I thought the fan as a vehicle for that was very interesting, because traditionally fans are a place, a space or a object where you can record a story or maybe a romance or a myth or a fairy tale, a fable, something important, some small important piece of information or something very beautiful, maybe a view of a castle or whatever. And this is the tradition of these fans as gifts that they were given to people as a little reminder of something. And I like that very much as a way of communicating my experience of China to people maybe who've never been here.
Hence the title of the work, Gift.
Absolutely, yes. I was reading at the time a person who's written about a slight tangent, but a gift exchange in terms of tribes exchanging gifts as a sort of power, as a power exchange. If you could give an enormous gift to another tribe, then you proved your power and your strength and your wealth. And in fact, tribes, I think he found tribes in the Amazon, he was an anthropologist, tribes in the Amazon actually threw important items across, over a cliff, so the other tribe could see, we have so much, we're so strong, don't fight us, because we can spare this very important object and we can throw it away, because we're so powerful. And so I really like this idea of a gift as an exchange and a place of negotiating culture.
And how would you compare Helen Coulson, the artist that was living and working in London, to Helen Coulson, the artist who is now living in Beijing. Couchman, I'm sorry, I just pronounced the name wrong. Couchman.
Yeah.
How has living in China influenced your work?
Well, the most important thing, which I always end up telling people, and it's really the most boring thing to say, but it's very integral, is that here I've been able to afford to work full time. And London is a very expensive city. So I was never, ever able, I was always working 3 days a week doing something else that wasn't terribly of relevance to my work. So to have the time has been wonderful, and I feel that's benefited me hugely. Mm. But more interestingly, I think the city has done what I hoped it would do. I came here because of this rapid change, mm-hmm. and it's something I've been interested in other places I've visited, and Beijing has not disappointed me in this way. It's extraordinary what's happening out there.
I don't know whether you will agree with this or what. Well, London is now considered by our standard a world city, and is an expensive city, and well, in some ways, right? But London has surely made its name in terms of its art, economic and political influence in the world. And Beijing is trying to be a world city of that rank. But I don't know. Beijing is changing and in that direction, but I don't know whether it will be getting more expensive also.
Maybe. I feel like since I've been here, I've noticed things have got a little more expensive just in the few years I've known Beijing. So maybe that is the downside of
expanding a city, huh?
I guess it's quite ironic. You think of London and you think of multiculturalism and all the cultural things to do there. It must be a wonderful place to be based as an artist. But it's quite ironic that living expenses are so expensive that those who are artists find it difficult to survive there. So
there's more artists, they say, in London than there are in any other European city, and yet arguably it's probably one of the most, if not the most expensive. Well, certainly one of them anyway.
So now you can work full time.
Yes.
Can you describe I'm interested in what a normal working day is like for a professional artist. What do you do?
Well, it's a very good question. I get
what
asked
time
this
do you
quite
get
frequently.
you must need a lot of self-discipline, right, to follow a fixed schedule.
Yes.
Because you can have a very flexible schedule.
I can have an extremely flexible schedule, and it's a dangerous situation to find yourself in. And in fact, I think for me, the first year I was here was a very intense experience because I arrived with very little money. Mm. I arrived with no language. I had a plan that I would make good
work.
You
are pretty brave.
But I didn't know what. You know, it was all still ahead of me, you know. Mm. And I came on my own. So it was very intense. And I didn't return home for the whole year. And I had for the first time 7 days a week, month in, month out at my disposal. And this opportunity shouldn't be wasted, was my feeling. So it was quite an experience.
I thought you came with a scholarship or what, or fund.
No, I came completely alone, actually, then. And So I tell friends, you know, people, certainly during the recession, friends have been made redundant. They say, they phone me up, they go, I was made redundant. I'm thinking of being freelance. So I start to tell them this is quite a difficult position. You have to have so much discipline to keep your deadlines, to make sure that you're doing what you set out to do, and maybe that you don't get dragged into work that you're not particularly interested in. Maybe it's important to have less money and do what you really feel you should with your time. And it's very hard balance to keep. But I feel very fortunate. Every day I'm here working like this, I feel extremely fortunate.
So do you have a daily routine?
I'm a funny person in that, for example, in England, I never watch soap opera regularly. My life is never particularly regular, and I find it quite hard to be in the same place each week to watch TV, never mind do anything else. So I'm irregular in my routine, but I do have a routine, and if I find it slipping, you know, I set my alarm for a little earlier in the morning, and I have a bad habit of working quite late at night. So I let myself do that, but I try and keep a routine as well.
Mm-hmm. Because when you ask most people with conventional jobs about their schedule. They tell you what time they start work, and they tell you what time they finish work, and they tell they tell you what they do when they're not working. But when you're an artist, it's not like a job. It's more like an identity. You can't stop being an artist. So are you always working? Are you working now? I mean, do you have a sketch pad?
She's
with
talking
you?
With us right now, doing nothing else.
I'm doing absolutely nothing right now.
She's just doing some critical thinking about the questions we ask.
Well, you don't know what she's thinking about. This could be part of the next project. I don't know.
No, I think it's a really good question. I think it's a dangerous thing to say because it sounds potentially very pretentious, but I think to be an artist and to be an author of anything, to be maybe a writer, to be an artist, to be somebody who creates something from, you know, your own sort of self, let's say. Of course, I have all the influences around me. I'm no island, but if you're surrounded by interesting things and you've got to negotiate these things through your own perspective, it's quite a challenge, and it takes some getting used to. It's quite a daunting task. And a lot of people, I think, in this position end up feeling very disillusioned and finding it very difficult. But I think pretentious, maybe sounding a bit pretentious, that you really live it. I think I wake up every morning as an artist. I don't think I put my hat on as an artist at 10 o'clock and become one. It's not like that.
Oh, yeah. So I do really marvel at the term liberal art, right? Liberal art. Really, you need to first liberate your mind and, you know, to be creative and think out of the box.
I was led to believe that all artists always carry around a small book with them. And if they see...
They also carry an air of, I'm an artist.
Some of them. Because if you see something that inspires you, or if you think of a, I don't know, some kind of sketch, or you have to record it somehow. Do you have one of these books? How do you record ideas?
I used to keep notebooks I've got boxes and boxes of notebooks at home, actually, which I sometimes look through because they're full of all sorts of things that I didn't note. You know, when you look at things at different times, you realise what is important. Different things become differently important in different times. So they're really useful, but I don't tend to do that so much. I do use my camera to note take. I would say I'm using my camera to note take almost every day, certainly a number of days a week. So that's become a very strong discipline for me. And recently, for example, I've just been printmaking again. And so that's been intensive days sort of working. I tend to get there only maybe 10:30, 11, but I'll work all the way through to 8, 9 o'clock. So that works out as quite a nice amount of time to really get something done. And again, you could argue that printmaking again is a kind of form of note taking. You know, as I said, my work is ideas led. So there's this feeling that I may have an idea about something and then I need to kind of experiment to see how that might be best communicated.
My next question is quite personal. How do you make money? Do you just sell your work, or is it always commissioned?
I do get commissions, but actually the most satisfactory way of me earning a living, and it does happen frequently, I'm glad to say, is people buy my work. They see it either maybe on my website, or they see it at someone else's home, or they see an exhibition, or they see work in the newspaper. I recently had an article in the New York Times, which was wonderful for catching people's interest. So it sort of works its way through. I don't have a dealer. I don't have a gallery that represents me, so that maybe makes me less traditional. But on the other hand, it means that I'm free to take up lots of different opportunities, and people do seem to enjoy my work and so buy it.
Then you need to, if you don't have a dealer, you need to take care of every aspect of the deal, right?
Absolutely.
So when they order a photo of yours, say,
yes,
you will get it printed out and send it delivered to them?
I just phoned a print company yesterday to make an order for a couple of prints for a collector. So I have to deal with that, yes. But I guess as a sort of mid-career artist, I think this is completely acceptable, really. And I actually like even if I had a dealer, I suspect I would be very hands-on. I like to make sure things are done completely, perfectly right. I like to check things. I want to make sure that the paper is the correct paper. I want to be sure it's just right. Mm-hmm. It's, after all, at the end of the day, it's a bit like, again, as I say, anybody who's creative, you're only as good as the last work you made. So I want it to be right. So I would probably always be hands-on.
Yeah, so taking the photo is just the first step, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, not the first, maybe the second, because you first need to have the idea.
And to what extent are you in control of the work you produce? For example, can you do anything you want and then you just approach people and say, would you like more of the same? Or do people, do organisations come to you and say, we want a series of photographs like this?
Well, for example, all the work that's archived on my website, which is not everything I've done, but it's, you know, a number of significant works, have all been things that I've wanted to work on and have not been commissioned. Both my books were not commissioned. One of them was funded, but it was not funded until I'd already made the project. Mm-hmm. So the work very much comes from me. Because I'm capable of taking photographs and I enjoy taking photographs, people do ask me increasingly for photographic commissions, and I do enjoy it. But it's a different process. I'm sort of fulfilling their need, and it's a nice. It's actually a bit more like having a job. You know, you get the feeling that you're dealing with a brief, and you can kind of work that out. Whereas when I go to the studio and it's just me and my ideas. In theory, anything's possible. But in fact, of course, again, with this creative process, you're your own worst enemy. So you have to kind of think it through and work out whether it's the right thing for you to be doing. Mm-hmm. Making things is sort of easy. It's the deciding what to make and why that is the hard part.
Yeah, right. When you decide what to make, do you consider is market potential? Or you just think that, okay, I like it. I really want to do this. I have to do this. I don't care about the outcome or the commercial value.
I definitely work on the second premise. Uh-huh. But of course, there are constraints to do with what I can afford to do. Uh-huh. I have long held fantastic, I think, idea for a sculpture that I would love to have in London or England. But it would cost a lot of money. And so it's probably never going to happen. So there are constraints. Most of the time, I can use the materials at hand and actually get a lot of things done. So it doesn't weigh on my mind, but I have to consider something.
Do you go to art galleries often?
I do go, probably not as often as you'd imagine. Mm. I go when I know someone who's exhibiting or a friend's invited me. I generally tend not to just go and wander about, although I do visit most of the museums here relatively regularly.
Mm. Which are your favourite ones? Which art galleries in Beijing do you go to?
Well, I obviously go up to 798 every now and again and really enjoy walking around looking there. The Today Art Museum is a nice place to visit, and they often have very interesting shows. Mm-hmm. The art museum down, I forget the street name, but just south of where I live, actually, in the centre of town, is a great, has some great shows. I saw an amazing Turner exhibition there, which was quite a surprise. It must have cost them a fortune to bring the works to China for the insurance. I was so impressed. Mm-hmm. Beautiful watercolours. So
how do you feel about the general cultural scene in Beijing? Are there enough galleries? Is there enough cultural exhibitions to satisfy your... your inspiration going around to see what other people are doing?
I think there's a lot going on, and in a way at some point I have to sort of cut off from all this and make my own work, because I could spend my whole time sort of going around other people's work. And actually I found that in London, where you're really spoilt for choice, at some point you just have to stop going to openings and seeing other works. You really have to spend time getting on with your own things. Mm-hmm. And of course, coming from London, I'm spoilt because we have more museums than, I mean, really, it's fantastic. And I think Beijing has good museums. I think it would be great if there was more public-funded museums in Beijing, actually. Because I think there's a lot of things going on that maybe it would be nice if the commercial aspect was kind of taken away from the situation. And it became more about, this would be interesting for education and Beijing's identity to show this work. This would be a powerful show. Lots of people would see this. I think that would be very exciting.
Well, there are a few huge galleries or museums,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That are probably free or, you know, public funded.
Yeah.
But I guess what it means is that actually there are now more private galleries, right?
A lot of private galleries. And although some of them are doing great work, you're aware, because of just the nature of it, that they have a different agenda than the public spaces.
So talking about galleries, who is your favourite artist and why?
Oh, that's a really difficult question. I always used to get asked this whenever I went for interviews when I was sort of 18 for art school. I'm not one for favourites. I know that's a real cop-out answer, but I remember saying much the same thing when I was 18. I just don't have favourites. I have a few people whose work I like for various reasons. I'm very interested in the photography of Jeff Wall, a Canadian. And strangely enough, I'm also quite interested in a photographer who I exhibited with last year, Ed Patinsky, also, strangely enough, a Canadian.
What kind of photographs do these guys make?
Well, Ed Patinsky's interesting, and the reason I showed with him was because he's been photographing China for some time. And in fact, I used to joke with friends that he got here before me. Our work is distinctly different, but he's visited some places that I would love to have seen. He photographed the Yangtze Valley before it was flooded, for example, and that was something that was a long-held dream of mine, which I didn't manage to achieve. But yes, I think he's made some very interesting images of China.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Wall hasn't taken any pictures of China that I know of, but during my student days he was quite influential on me. Just his way of... he sets up a scene in a way that I would have never done myself, but it's just this very interesting question of truth or story in an image, rather than photography that is traditionally about sort of documenting or finding something. And I quite like that. You know, where the truth lies is quite an interesting thing, especially with photography, because of the way we perceive it.
Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, I really want to talk about a phenomenon noticed over the years that now with the coming of the internet age, many people stop to go to galleries. I don't know why. Maybe it's easy to log on to the website and go to the virtual gallery and just take a look there. But yeah, physically going somewhere, I think it really demands a lot of courage and.
Yes.
And time. I mean, I remember I used to go to the National Gallery of Art in China, well, in 美术馆, you know, in Chinese, in 美术馆, right, in my college days. And I think I stopped going there for quite some time because of work and also because of, you have other interests. When you were a student, you have a lot of time, it seems.
Sure.
And then when you are at work, you are busy with stuff, and also you got you are now people stuck in the multimedia age. Probably they got we have a shorter span of attention, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's hard, and it's hard to make the time and I really appreciate that. And I know when I have shows, people will say, you know, I'm definitely coming, and then they'll come on the last day because they've been so busy. And I completely understand. I do it myself. I think a lot of shows are completely full of people on the last day before they close because everyone's thinking, oh, I didn't get there. I think it's hard, but I really feel very strongly that the internet is definitely no substitute for seeing the work, because to know the scale and the texture and the colour and the feeling and the way the work is hung, and to be able to contemplate it without sort of advertising floating around the sides of the image is just a very special and interesting and different experience.
Yeah, I know, but it's time consuming.
But
as
it's
you
very
said,
time
many
consuming.
People are busy and they probably don't have much time to do it, because when you are in a gallery, probably it takes half a day, right, if you want to look at them carefully.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I always suggest to people that you walk around quite quickly and just keep going, and then walk back to the things that caught your eye, because we all have an attention span, and maybe an hour is plenty, and if it's a big show, that's really hard to to cope with. I actually had quite a bad habit in London of going around shows in the wrong direction too, because it meant that I didn't have to queue behind lots of people if it was a famous show.
No, that's an idea.
But I'm not sure if the curators would thank me for putting that on the radio, because they've beautifully crafted this thing and I'm doing it in reverse, which is probably maybe not ideal. But no, I mean, the internet's amazing, and I know that certainly living here, I really, for the English language, you know, for me, it's fantastic to be able to look up almost anything you can possibly imagine, find information about it and a reference to it.
Praise the Lord for Wikipedia.
It's fabulous. But I just think that this is one of the wonderful things about art, that you actually do need to understand it, you need to see it. You just have to, at the end of the day.
So on your website there's a section with information about you, and of course you're from Britain, and I believe you grew up in several places: Wales, Staffordshire, Kent and Hampshire, various places around the UK. Yes. And it says that you believe these places played a significant role in your development as an artist. What role did they play? And also, when did you decide to become an artist?
In terms of where I've lived, I think knowing different landscapes is fundamental to my experience. And I think that's key in some way. It's this thing of how much of you is nature and how much of you is nurture, you know. Was I born this way, or did I pick it up along the way? And I think it's probably a bit of both. And I definitely feel that being in different places has also got me used to the idea of, in a way, of travelling. And travelling's always been very key in my life. Even when I wasn't travelling, I was hoping to travel. So that's one thing. Although none of these places sound particularly exotic, I think to do that, all that travel as an early age, has been quite key in a way to my outlook, generally speaking, whether I was an artist or not. And as to when I think I became an artist, well, aged 4 and a half, I used to wait in Wales. We lived in a very remote area, and so myself and another little girl were taken to school in turn by our parents, because it was about a 40-minute drive, and someone else would then pick us up, because it, you know, took too much of the day. And so I would wait at the bottom of our road for them to pick me up, and on warm days my mother used to show me how to draw the mountainside, age 4 and a half. So I obviously showed an interest early on. Actually, she tells an interesting story, because she was a little bit worried about me because I wouldn't scribble. She would give me pens, and she had this idea that she was going to have a daughter who liked to scribble. I was the first child, so she had plenty of time to focus on what I was going to do or what I wasn't.
She loves art?
She loves art, and she really thought I was going to be scribbling, you know, and I wouldn't. I just wouldn't, apparently. And then finally...
You just stared at the piece of paper?
Just got wriggled and got down, you know, just wasn't taking any notice. Mm-hmm. And she was like, this is... bit strange, you know, I want my daughter to be interested. And but apparently I drew, I obviously don't know, but she said I waited and I waited, and then I drew a cat, and I drew four paws and whiskers and ears and a tail, everything. But I waited, she would suggest I waited until I had all the components in my mind. I didn't want to scribble, I just wanted to wait till I could draw the cat.
Do you still have this picture? It's not on your website, I don't
think. It's a shame, isn't it? I've often said to her, where is it? And she has kept a lot of my funny things from when I was young, but I think, unfortunately, that one is gone.
And do you come from a creative family? Did your mother or other members of the family have any creative occupation?
I think it's interesting, this business of nature and nurture, coming back to that. I guess I could say that it is running in the family. My mother has never done anything professionally with what she does, but she enjoys very much taking photographs, and took photographs all through my childhood. And then my grandfather was fantastic with calligraphy. My mother's father, fantastic with calligraphy, and did bookbinding and all sorts of things, when actually he was raised to be a stockbroker. So he had this really creative streak, even though it wasn't part of the expectation of his life. And then his sister was an artist, quite a well-known artist, and had books published and watercolours. There's a mural by her in London, which is, I think, listed, so it will be there. And then previous to that, we've got paintings by relatives who are mildly collectible, you know, just small-time collectible. And they would travel you know, this is 150 years ago, they would have the chance maybe to travel, and they would paint what they saw. So we've got pictures of Norway by some relative on the wall, and one relative was surveyor to Brunel when he made the Bristol suspension bridge. So there's a kind of creative streak through my grandfather, my mother's father.
But your answer to my previous question, I think, was quite telling, because I asked, when did you decide to become an artist? But you answered by saying when you became aware that you were an artist. So I think that's telling of a true artist. It sounds like you you consider you discovered what you were instead of deciding what you wanted to become.
I think that's you've put it so well. I think you're probably really right. And I think that it's a funny thing, because I think it's quite hard for people to realize what they should be or what they are, I should say, more precisely. And I think in a way I'm lucky, because it was always quite obvious in a sense to me what I should be. Though, of course, like most young people, I struggled with it, because I was very worried about the fact that I wouldn't make any money. I wouldn't be able to make a living doing this. How could, you know, to be an artist is a very hard choice. So I worried a lot, and I spent a lot of time at art school wondering whether I shouldn't be trying to be a designer or trying to be something else. And in the end, I just realized that it was important to relax and just do what I felt I was best at, most interested by. But I've got a lot of friends who it's not been so clear to them what they should do, and it's quite a struggle. You know, I've got friends who maybe got to 30 before they've realized, or 35 or even older, before they've really realized where their passion and their interests lie. Because especially if you're more of an all-rounder, I mean, I wasn't terribly good at maths or English at school. I mean, it was okay, but I was never going to excel. So in a way, I was lucky by that, because it pointed me in the direction of art, even when I tried to fight it. Whereas I have friends who would maybe pass lots of exams, but what did that mean in terms of what they wanted to do? Quite hard.
Did you really feel bad if you did poorly in a math exam?
I was given so much trouble for it. Honestly, it was just awful.
Your parents pressured you to do well, or they just let it be?
You're always led to believe that you have to have all these exams. And of course, it's a good thing. It's a good discipline for children to try and do something. You know, maybe I would have been great if I applied myself. You know, who knows? But math was never my forte. And I took my math, my basic math exam once, and I got, you were meant to have a C to pass in England, and I got an E, so I didn't pass. So then I retook it again 6 months later, and I got a D. And then I was like, oh, do I have to retake it again? And I think my mother just said to me, you know what? I don't think you're a mathematician. Maybe don't worry. So I retook it two or three times, and then we gave up.
So eventually, you say, in art college, this was when you finally decided yourself that art was the way forward, despite all the potential difficulties of living a lifestyle like that. What was the reaction from your family and friends? Did anybody try to dissuade you from this path?
It's difficult. My father, probably very wisely, hasn't really ever given much of an opinion on it. I think he'd just like to see me married, which I think is, that's a little unfair. He's a great traveller and adventurer himself, but I think he wants me to be happy, and so that's what he's thinking about, and hasn't given much opinion to the rest. I think he's quite proud of what I do sometimes, and then sometimes he's my best critic, you know, like parents often are. And my mother, we've had our moments. It's been difficult at times. She's been very supportive in some ways, and then sometimes she's been very concerned. I remember her saying to me when I received a place for my MA, she said, really, I think you should get a job now, you know, you shouldn't really be doing this. And I can see her point of view. You know, she's worried, she's got this daughter who's not making a living, and I'm going off to do more art school. So it's hard, but in fact I've worked hard, and I guess in the end I've prove to her that I can manage to do both. So I did my master's after that conversation. I did it anyway, and I worked my way through. So I did it part-time so that I could have a job to pay to do it. So, you know, in that way she pushed me forward, and I managed to do both.
And what do you think you got from studying at art school? Because many people consider to be artistic is something you're born with and you can't learn to be an artist. What did you gain from studying art?
I think it's an interesting question. When I was in my late teens, I was quite close to a family friend, someone who was my grandmother's age, who was quite a well-known artist in the UK, portrait painter and draftsperson, and she was a live wire. She was a fantastic person to know. She'd been an artist all her life. She actually married her teacher at art school, and just wonderfully creative. I remember she came to draw a portrait of me, and I photographed her, and it was a wonderful weekend that we spent together. And she looked at my portfolio, and I was about 19 at the time, thinking about going to art school, and she said to me, "Helen, please don't go to art school." She said, it might not be the, you know, it might ruin what you do." And she was really serious, and I could appreciate, even then I really understood what she meant in a way, because to be put through different processes is great, but it also might have its downsides. You're in other people's hands if you follow this. Mm-hmm. And we are product of many things, including our education, and she was worried it might just not be the right thing. In fact, of course, I've done a full education in art. I've done a master's and a degree, so I've been studying. I studied through my early 20s for about 5 years. But I'm glad, because I think I have hopefully enough courage to continue with what I would do. But I think I liken it to being a sports person. You have to keep fit. You need to look at things. You need to be put through the exercises. Maybe you need to draw every day for 6 months. Maybe you need to go out and take photographs every day for 4 years, because you need to keep that part of your mind and that part of your sensibilities fit and strong and prepared for when you have an idea, and then you will work on it well. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to say whether it's better or worse, but I think I benefited in the long run. I think it was better that I did that.
So you think you benefited from your proper system of academic education?
I think it's interesting too, because the other thing is every student you ever meet, often they'll say, "Oh, my course isn't as good as I wanted it to be. It's not everything I hoped it would be." You know, my tutor's not always there, and he doesn't always tell me what to do, and I don't know. But you know, I actually feel very strongly that they're always disappointing, these courses. What you have to do is take from it what you can, and it's up to you, because you start to be your own person. You start to be the professional. They're facilitating something that you might need and that you might use, but that's all they can do, really. Even in your degree, you might be in that position, and you've got to take the best of it. I mean, I was in my BA was at an art school that was, you know, contemporary art school, where you didn't have to go and do life drawing. No one hardly did any life drawing. But I decided that it was absolutely crucial for me to be able to draw, and that even if I could already draw, I should draw better and more freely and more confidently. And so I went to life drawing with about two other or three other people for about a year. No one else went. No one else asked me to go. I just went, and I decided that was important. And I think that's not the best example, because it sort of sounds like I'm being a traditionalist, but I think what I mean is that it's important to take up the opportunity and take control of that opportunity and use that to the best of your ability and not expect them to give it all to you.
So talking about taking the opportunity and making art.
You don't have time to get the answer, I'm afraid.
Oh.
And I think, we've got to save it for next time.
Okay.
Excuse me. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting conversation.
We should just say, if you want to find out more, you can on the website, which is www.helencouchman.com.
You can see
that on the message board now if you look.
Yeah, and I think we have a very interesting topic next time. I'm really looking forward to it. It's really a very fascinating conversation. I mean, as an artist, I'm sure Helen is really a charming person.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'm definitely sure that the work out of you must be pretty impressive to everybody who would love to look at it. And the next one I'm looking forward to is about her grandmother's hats. And it's a fascinating little book. And next time we're going to apply for a video feed to let you take a look. So for the time being, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.